Okay, thank you. So my title is Research Theory of Blah, and I want to ask you, who has an idea of what it means? Cool, because I don't either. Maybe after the talk you will still have no idea, it's fine. I want to start with a disclaimer. So I wrote the abstract, if you read the abstract, quite a while ago, so this talk will probably not be very related to it. Well, maybe yes, we'll see. The other disclaimer is that all the characters appearing in this talk are fictional, and any resemblance of real persons is purely coincidental. Okay, let's start. Meet Jake. This is Jake. Jake's motivations in life are very simple to understand. In fact, what Jake wants is garlic bread. Yes, Jake wants garlic bread, and now we have to figure out how can Jake make garlic bread. From the point of view of linguistics or syntax, garlic bread consists of two words, garlic and bread. So that suggests that to make garlic bread, we would need garlic and bread. But actually, any cook would tell you that to make garlic bread, you also need butter. But then, I mean, these are some like basic ingredients you might want, but you also need an oven to bake the garlic bread in. Then, you know, if you have an oven that is not powered in any way, that's not going to be much useful. So you might want to have some power source to like provide energy for the oven to bake the garlic bread in. Well, what else? If you are Jake, then you might also want to have some knowledge, which might not be pre-existing, of how to assemble these elements into the garlic bread. So for that, you might need some cookbook, maybe, that will provide you with the knowledge you would need to make garlic bread a reality. Well, what else? Is there anything else we need? I think any millennial would probably tell you that garlic bread is not complete until you've bragged about it to your peers. So you might also want to be able to communicate some idea of garlic bread that you've made to others. For that, you would need some social skills. But if that is not applicable, then maybe we can replace it with social media instead. I think social media would usually do, at least in this day and age. What else? Well, let's see. There are certain people in the world that you really would not want the picture of garlic bread to be communicated to. So, for example, the Avenger. And for that, you would need a secret key to send your image of garlic bread securely. But since Jake is a bit paranoid, he might assume that Avenger has a quantum computer. So this secret key really should be a private secret key. And for that, he could use some qubits entangled that he shares with Instagram. Obviously, you shouldn't share your entangled qubits with Snapchat because you might not ever see them again. I mean, you can see now, this is getting a bit out of hand. Is there any way we can simplify all this? Well, I reckon that in current capitalist society, we can actually replace all of this just with money. So that's the final answer to everything, I guess. Well, there's a lot of instructions just to make garlic bread. How can Jake make sense of all of this? Well, there are a few options. Would Jake choose the dynamicist approach, or realist in David's words, in which he would build some complicated mathematical model and then predict the behavior of garlic bread and all the other constituents, and in the end end up with the garlic bread? Or would he choose the ultra pragmatist approach, go and buy garlic and bread, bake them, and then enjoy his garlic bread? What do you think? Who thinks he should choose the dynamicist approach? Oh, David, no. who thinks he should choose the ultra pragmatist approach? Okay, there's quite a few. I think Jake would choose like some kind of middle ground, some kind of resource theorist approach. So how can we combine these two? Well, we can build complicated models and then break them. It's probably not going to work. Well, let's go back to our list of instructions and see what we can make of this. What are the common elements of all these different instructions to make garlic bread? We can see, you know, the left-hand side is always the same. The left-hand side of all these relations just tells you what is the main objective. The main objective is garlic bread. And the right-hand side basically gives you a list of resources you need in order to produce garlic bread. But there are different lists of resources, so how does that make sense? Well, one way to make sense of this would be to build a resource theory, a framework for describing how to use resources to achieve certain objectives. So, for example, we could have resource theory of cooking, which would describe how you combine resources like food items, and then to get some meal. We could have some resource theory of chemistry that would describe some chemical reactions that go on, for example, when you bake the garlic bread. We could have resource theory of thermodynamics, which would describe the laws of thermodynamics and how we can, for example, convert the electrical energy coming from the power source and into the heat that the oven produces. We could have a resource theory of knowledge. For example, the knowledge of how to prepare a garlic bread. And I'm actually not sure about this next one. About 2 days ago, when I was preparing this talk, I stumbled upon a paper which was called Resource Theory of Social Exchange. When I looked into it, I realized it's actually not very suitable for this talk because it doesn't really relate to all the other resource theories, whether they exist or not. But this one, I mean, I should have expected that it will be a different beast. There was lots of words, not mathematics. I mean, obviously, it was from a sociology journal. So let's just leave that out for now. We could also have resource theory of information and communication. For example, if you're familiar with the Shannon theory, then you could try to include that there. You have a resource theory of entanglement, resource theory of economics, and many others. For example, if you wanted to describe the capabilities of the eavesdropper's quantum computer, we could use resource theory of complexity, computational complexity. Yeah, they seem to be everywhere. Well, actually, that's what I was about to do. So, yeah, that's actually true. Let's get back to the talk. What is research theory? Research theory, as the name suggests, should consist of elements which will be called resources. So in our bready, garlicky example, those would be things like bread, garlic, or breadcrumbs, and many other things you can probably imagine. And apart from these resources, there would also be some relation, which would basically tell us how these resources can be converted into each other. So it would be describing the conversions that are possible while you're doing cooking. So for example, when you are cooking, you can convert bread into breadcrumbs. That seems plausible. You can also convert garlic and bread into, okay, it's not going to be great garlic bread, but you can make some garlic bread out of those. Usually these conversions are not going to be reversible. So actually, both of these are probably not reversible. Breadcrumbs cannot be converted back to bread while doing like standard, you know, using standard cooking procedures. And similarly, once you have made garlic bread, you cannot convert it back and have bread and garlic separately. Actually, the irreversibility of these conversions is very important. The reversible conversions are somehow not so interesting. In fact, usually in resource theories, people would consider two objects, say resources, which can be converted into each other reversibly as just the same resource, because we can just treat them the same, we can convert them and back. So really the irreversible conversions are the interesting ones. Another thing to note is how many, okay, I should go faster. I'm gonna skip this, sorry. There's just one thing I want to point out here is that the plus, this plus. So who has an idea of what this plus here means? I kind of have been using it somehow loosely, but is this plus an element of the resource theory as I have defined it? What do you think? Anyone has an idea? Well, we have the resources, we have the conversions, but I haven't talked about any way of combining the resources together. So that's what this plus does, for example. In here, it would mean just, I have both garlic and bread. So it would be somehow this kind of logical and kind of relation that would combine the two together, but in a way that I can still manipulate them separately. Usually, when we talk about resource theories and we have resources which come from some particular context, they also come with some extra structure. So this plus would be one of that kind of structure. Another structure resources could have is if they correspond to processes. So I'm just gonna illustrate very schematically. A process is something that has an input, so there is some input. We've seen boxes already. We had Nitik and David, and has some output. So that's what I would call a process. There is some input and some output. And once you have these processes, then usually you have some structure which corresponds to how you can combine these processes together. So if I have one process F, then I can combine it with another process G. So this gives me extra structure. Yeah, that's all I wanted. That's fine. Thanks. This gives me extra structure among the resources and in particular among the processes, which I can then use. So how can I use this structure of the processes? Well, I can actually get rid of these conversions as a primary notion in the resource theory. Instead, what I will say is that, bread can be converted into breadcrumbs if there is some process, something like this, that actually does the conversion, that converts bread into breadcrumbs. So now, before, the conversion was just some abstract notion, oh, bread can be converted into breadcrumbs. And now we are saying there is some process, which I presumably I would also know what that process is, maybe use the food processor that does the job, and therefore also tells me how would I go about doing that process if I wanted. So there's a little problem with this, which is that one can imagine processes that convert breadcrumbs into bread, but as I said here, breadcrumbs should not be converted into bread in the context of cooking. But you can, for example, imagine that there is a process in which you take breadcrumbs, throw them in the bin, and then your flatmate turns up from the bakery and brings bread. So that's a process that takes breadcrumbs and produces bread. It's not really a process that's part of cooking, though. It would be more like a part of shopping in some strange way. So this just shows that this definition of convertibility in terms of the existence of some process that does the conversion is a little bit too naive. What we would like to say is that not that there is any process that does this conversion, but rather there is some process which corresponds to cooking that does the conversion. So this process of buying the bread in the bakery would not be a cooking kind of process. So these processes that would correspond to cooking in this sense, we would call free processes, and the name free processes, okay. We would say that bread can be converted into breadcrumbs if there is some free process that converts bread into breadcrumbs. And the name comes from basically some kind of intuition that the free processes are the ones that do not increase the value of our resources. So if I have a resource and I apply a free process to it, then I get the resource back that is not as valuable as the one that I had before. And similarly, we would also have some free resources, and those would be just resources that have no value at all, that I can create as much as I wish. So in this sense, we would say now a new, you could say new definition of resource theory would be, there would be some processes and resources among them. And within that set of processes, there would be some free processes. So in our cooking example, bringing bread from the shop would be a process, but not really a free process. Usually you might imagine that filling a pot with water would be a free process in cooking, at least in Canada, we would say, or most of the Western world. Using the food processor or using the oven would be free processes. Of course, all the free processes are also included in all processes. Yeah, putting ketchup on pasta is not really part of cooking, I would suggest. So now we have a new notion of resource theory, which looks something like this. We have some set of all processes, which are all the things we want to be able to describe in any way. And within those processes, there are some distinguished processes, which are the free processes. Really, the idea of resource theory, even though so far we came from some particular example and then used our intuition about cooking to determine what is free and what is not free, the idea of resource theory is that you start with this partition into free and non-free processes, and that is what defines your resource theory. Then, of course, there is a lot of choice you have to make, but the task is basically to connect this choice of this partition to some particular restriction there is. For example, what can you do while cooking? So another thing that that this partition gives you is that you can now order the resources. You can order them according to how valuable they are. So we would say that one resource X is more valuable than another resource Y. If we can convert X to Y, or in other words, if there is a free process, Phi, which takes this resource X and creates Y from it. So in this sense, we could say, we go back, bread is more valuable than breadcrumbs in cooking. And having garlic and bread is also more valuable than having garlic bread, unfortunately, in this sense. Okay, so I will come back to this ordering probably later if I have any time, probably not. Okay. I'll skip this. Now, okay, I will not skip this. So what I want to say is that there is this kind of arbitrariness in how we choose which processes are the free ones or which conversions are allowed. So here we would say, oh, the conversion of garlic bread and butter into garlic bread is an allowed conversion or a free process in the resource here of cooking. And cooking would also include the use of ovens and power sources and everything that comes with a kitchen. Also the knowledge of how to do the cooking. For example, the knowledge of how to prepare garlic bread, those would all be as part of the free resources. So by including these items like oven and others into the set of free resources, that's what defines our resource sphere of cooking. And that also gives us what are the possible conversions we can obtain in that particular situation. But then there will be other situations. For example, if we want to account for all the work that's been done and all the heat flows, then we might want to not have power sources as free processes, and we would have to account for them explicitly, like in this line. So now we can see that the same situation can be viewed in multiple ways, and in particular from perspective of different resource theories. Then the question is, which one do you choose? So now we are kind of back to the question of, we have a long list of instructions, but we don't know which one to use. And that question is basically answered in kind of opposite manner as to what David was advocating. So usually in resource theories, we would choose the three processes based on some kind of observations or empirical laws that we have gotten from our observations of which processes are natural, which processes occur. For example, if you look at cook shows in TV, then you will observe what kind of processes are possible in cooking, and then you can include those as part of your free processes in that resource theory. Another possibility is to choose the free processes based on some underlying reality, or you could say dynamical model that describes the situation. That one is not always available, especially in sciences that go kind of more complex than physics. In physics, actually, we would often use the dynamical models to tell us what is the right notion of free processes in particular situation. It's not clear, though, which one of those is better. It might be different for different situations. And also, if you have wrong dynamical model, then of course that will kind of give you wrong indication of what is the right set of free processes to use in that situation. Another requirement that we would like to have on the set of free processes, this is a bit of a tangent, okay, but I can say it, is that if we have free processes and free resources and we just use those, we should not be able to get something that's outside of the set of free processes, so some notion of closure, basically. So that would say, for example, that if the conversion of x to y is possible and also conversion of y to z is possible, then it should be possible to convert x to z. Seems natural. For example, we can convert bread to toast in the oven. That's free in cooking. We can convert toast to breadcrumbs in the food processor. That's also free. So converting bread to breadcrumbs should also be free. Sounds reasonable. This is a necessary requirement, but it's not very, it's somewhat strong, but it still leaves a lot of options that we will have to use other ideas to distinguish between. Okay, and the last bit, I would like to say a little bit more about this notion of ordering of resources and their value. So we've seen that there is this ordering of resources that one is more valuable if we can convert them from one to another. And here is one like subset of the resource theory of cooking, where we could say, oh, if we have garlic and bread, then we can create garlic and toast by baking the bread in the oven, for example. We can also create just fresh bread and untoasted bread with garlic on it or garlic butter, whatever. And then use that in the oven to make garlic bread. Or we could take garlic and toast and make some kind of strange garlic bread from it as well, if you will. And likewise, we could use the food processor to break the toast into breadcrumbs. And in that way, would create garlic and breadcrumbs from garlic and toast. And now, in the final few minutes of the talk, I would like to basically talk about how we can give value to these resources. So one way you could think of giving value to resources would be some function f, which would assign, okay, let's say this, the set of all of these resources, set of all of these resources, we could call them R, and the function would give us, give us real values for each of those resources. So there will be some kind of assigning value to those resources. And I would call this kind of valuation of resources fateful if it is the case that whenever x can be converted to y, so x and y here would be some resources. So this would be true if and only if the value of those resources is like so. So the value of x would be strictly larger than value of y. So this would be a fateful valuation. Now, okay, I know this is like very late, but I want to ask one more question for you, and that is it possible to evaluate these five resources with a fateful valuation? What do you think? Is it possible to find a single function which gives value to those five resources in a manner that respects this requirement, that whenever one resource can be converted into another, their values are strictly ordered and vice versa? Is this possible?
You mean for this specific
example? For this specific example of these five items. Yes?
Yes.
Do you know what it is?
No. One for the bottom, two for the middle, two, and three for the first one.
So that would be giving a single value for these two, a single value for those two, such that this is the lowest, and then higher. So that would be some notion of valuation that would respect all the orderings. It wouldn't be a faithful one because you would only have one direction of this implication, right? It would be true that this implies this, but not the other. Actually, okay, I won't tire you anymore. In this case, it is not possible, and that's a very common feature of resource theories. So what I just wanted to illustrate with this is that in generic resource theories, in fact, all but the most simplest ones, it is not possible to give a single measure or value to the resources which would respect the convertibility relation. So for example, if someone comes up to you and tells you, oh, I have this measure of some resource and it's the best measure of the resource and this is why, then you should be skeptical of that, because usually there is no single measure of resource that captures all the complexity there is in this kind of resource theories. So this is Jake. Jake wanted to make garlic bread. And now Jake understands how to make garlic bread thanks to resource theories. You like Jake? Thank you.
I've never heard of resource theory before. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, I can't see how this will be useful in physics.
Yes. I haven't talked about physics, I guess, so that's a good question. In physics, usually people use resource theories. So nowadays, there's a large community of people using resource theories in information theory, in particular quantum information theory. So you would use resource theory to analyze tasks like information processing or maybe quantum teleportation, key distribution, all these kind of things are very natural to study from the resource theory point of view. And in many ways, you could say that the framework does not really provide you, at least at the moment. One part of what I'm doing is trying to actually develop some more technical tools which would help in using that framework. But at the moment, I would say the framework is not really that useful in providing you technical tools to derive new results, but it's useful in a sense of organizing the known results and also finding connections between different applications of it, because it's very broad and general framework that you can then use. For example, if you have some result about how you can distill entangled pairs of photons, say, and you have some result about that, like how much of them you can distill from certain states, then using this framework gives you a way to translate that result to other situations which might not be immediately obviously related to that. It's just because the framework is very abstract in one sense, and it's, that kind of gives it more power of this kind of translating results between different situations. So it's more of a, I think of it more of as like a organizational framework to help you think about problems and maybe organize the knowledge in some useful way. In terms of deriving new results, it might not be as useful, I would say.
Let's try Tomáš again.